Good morning, friends, and welcome to Our Times with Craig Barnes, and I am Craig Barnes. Friends, if you are listening to this program right now, you are having an experience that is, relatively speaking, rare in America. You're listening to one of the few media outlets that is not controlled by Clear Channel or Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation or AOL Time Warner, Viacom, or Disney. Today, six corporations control 90% of all our media. But this concern is not just about economics or statistics. This is about the content of what you and I and most Americans are allowed to listen to or read or see films about. And of course, in a democracy, this is about whether there can be sufficient diversity of opinion for an educated public to make wise political decisions. The narrower the band of information that is available in all of our media, the less well-informed or positively stupid decisions we will make. It is perhaps no exaggeration that if in the years 2002-2003, American media had not been so bound together by a common culture, and as a result the American public so separated from the facts, we would not have made that stupid decision to go to war in Iraq. That was a war based entirely upon pretext, unexamined propaganda from the White House, unquestioning reporting of CIA conclusions, manipulation of news outlets from the New York Times to Fox to the Wall Street Journal, and there was perhaps no outstanding voice of reason, with the possible exception of the McClatchy papers. Already by 2002, the consolidation of media in America had closed down the ability of the public to hold its government responsible or to respond to propaganda and falsehoods with accurate information. All of this should have been possible under our stated allegiance to the First Amendment and freedom of the press, but consolidation of all our media sources ends up giving us media that serves the 1% and ignores the 99%. Here is how it worked out. Clear Channel controlled then and controls now over 1,200 radio stations. Suppose you were opposed to the Iraq War and tried to express that view on one of those 1,200 stations. That is what the Dixie Chicks did. Clear Channel cut them off, not just on one station, but on 1,200. And yet the danger is even greater. Bain Capital is a major owner of Clear Channel. The people who surrounded Mitt Romney at Bain Capital could not have been very interested during the 2012 election season to share information about the successes of the Affordable Care Act. Indirectly, therefore, Mitt Romney had the capacity to close down and block out from 1,200 radio stations any praise for Obama or for the Affordable Care Act, or, more importantly, information of vital importance to the presidential campaign. When one owner controls hundreds of stations, that control can have enormous political implications. Suppose you live in New York or L.A., Chicago, Dallas, Houston, or Phoenix, and this week, you reject Paul Ryan's latest budget proposal to cut $5 trillion in social programs, education, scientific research, and Medicare. You would like to get your opposition on television news. In any one of these cities, you are in Rupert Murdoch country. Unfortunately, Murdoch's conservative administrators gave daily instructions and now still give daily instructions to Fox anchors in all those cities. During the George W. Bush administration, those instructions went so far as to include reading verbatim news releases from the White House. Today, with Murdoch still in control, the News Corporation is not likely to showcase criticism of Paul Ryan. Well, you say, okay, you're a progressive and you're creative and you will get go somewhere else, maybe another network. Viacom owns CBS. They might be interested. Some of us remember when CBS used to do news big time. Unfortunately today, Viacom also owns Paramount Pictures, MTV Films, Nickelodeon Films, and Star Trek franchise, etc. They are into the entertainment business in a very big way, and news staffs have shrunk. Investigating reporting has dwindled. Well, okay, you say, let's try Disney. They own ABC. ABC also used to be interested in the news. But again, ABC owns Disney and Disney Pictures, Touchstone, Hollywood Pictures, Miramax, ESPN, and they are clearly focused on entertainment and the bottom line that comes from entertainment. Okay, you say, well, now let's try radio. But here again, it is the same story. Viacom owns 180 radio stations. Disney owns 53 radio stations. And neither is much interested in stirring up political conversation. Maybe you are a resilient, hardworking progressive, so you try to get your message in books or magazines. Unfortunately, here it is the same story. And when we talk about six corporations owning 90% of the media in America, we are talking not just about television, but about books, magazine, film, and radio as well. True, we live in the new age of internet communications, and maybe there is a chance here to balance the news and generate stories from many more sources. But here, once again, we are faced with giants that dominate the picture. We want them to be fair. We want them not to filter or judge the content of our internet communications. We want to be able to trust them. And maybe we can. But here there is a caution. In the last presidential election, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, AT&T's political PAC contributed $350,000 to the House Tea Party caucus. Would Verizon be any better? Maybe not. In 2007, Verizon blocked Narol Pro-Choice from using a text messaging application because of its political content. According further to the Center for Responsive Politics, AT&T's total political contributions from 1999 to 2012 equaled $45,492,000. Republicans received almost $24 million and Democrats somewhat more than $20 million. In the last election cycle, Verizon contributed $1,349,000. This does not prove that either AT&T or Verizon would reject your political content or filter liberal protestations out of your internet communication, but it does prove decisively that they maintain a strong interest in influencing American politics. To allow internet communications to be under the thumb of these two giants is not safe for democracy. The gateway should be broad and not narrow, and should not be guarded by only two gatekeepers who have demonstrated a long-term and expensive interest in influencing politics. We have a federal agency that is supposed to keep an eye on all this. It is called the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC. During the 8 years of the George W. Bush administration, the chairman of the FCC, Michael Powell, reflected the view of that consolidation and the point of view that consolidations and mergers come at no risk to democracy. And under Powell's leadership, the FCC repeatedly authorized newspapers and television stations to be owned by the same corporation, or it authorized the consolidation of television stations, and the net effect was, again, to shrink the sources of public information. During this whole time, Democrat Michael J. Copps served as a member of the FCC. He was often the lone voice of dissent. He'd come to the commission with great experience. He had been an assistant secretary in the Department of Commerce and had led a 400-person team working to improve global market access and market share for nearly every sector of American industry. But when Copps became a member of the FCC and advanced these positions, his whole effort was stymied by Michael Powell's leadership. For years, therefore, while the Bush administration sought to improve the chances for success for the News Corporation, Viacom, Disney, and Clear Channel, Michael Copps stood out as the one visible, articulate, and courageous champion of diversity and equal access to all forms of communication. Michael Copps is currently spearheading a new media and democracy reform initiative at Common Cause, the National Citizens Action Group. For the last year and a half, he's been crisscrossing the nation to energize a grassroots discussion of what he sees as the declining state of America's news and information infrastructure. He keeps turning our attention back to the government's neglect of its important public interest and oversight responsibilities. In addition to all these obvious qualifications, on a personal note, Mike Copps received a Ph.D. in United States history from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, a university, I will tell you, Michael, also attended by three of my grandsons. They did well to go to the same place that nourished and brought forward this outstanding public servant. And I hope they take the same history courses that you did, Michael. It's with great pleasure. I welcome you to the program this morning. You're on the phone with us from Washington, D.C. Happy to have you here. Welcome, Michael.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for your nice words. And thank you most of all for that perceptive and elegant and eloquent overview of the challenges we're facing in America's media market right now. There's nothing more important, nothing that should be more important in our national radar scope when it comes to figuring out how we're going to dig America out of the hole that it's in right now.
I've been moving around advocating for the one big thing is to get a hold of banking And somebody else says to me, no, 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 the one big thing is to get a hold of media consolidation. Oh, no, no, the one big thing is to get a hold of inequality. So we've got a lot of one big things. But I agree with you that this consolidation, limiting the numbers of sources, the diversity in sources, is huge in its implications for democracy.
Well, you know, there is no reform in those other areas until you have media reform. There's no reform of democracy until you reform media. There is no democracy until you have media democracy. And it's true, as you so aptly point out, that the country faces lots of problems right now. And sometimes when I go around in my crisscross in the country, I'll ask some people sitting in the audience, pick 8 or 10 out, and say, what do you think the biggest problem is facing the United States right now? And you'll get a whole smorgasbord of answers to creating jobs or making sure people have health insurance or fixing our broken education system or doing something about climate change or energy dependence. And I say those are all great, and I understand why you feel so strongly about them, but let me tell you this, none of those problems is going to go anywhere until you have a media that will pay attention to those problems and dig for facts and dig for truth and be serious about getting to the crux of those problems, and we don't have that media anymore. This consolidation that you talked about has led to a strafing of the newsrooms across the nation, and it's led to the firing of tens of thousands of reporters. People who should be walking the beats looking for a story are instead walking the streets looking for a job. A lot of newsrooms have been shuttered, and what passes for news now is mostly glitzy infotainment and talk radio and shout cable. And all those distressing political ads we see, you know, more people in the last election learned about candidates or heard about candidates, I should say, they didn't learn much, heard about the races more from political ads than they heard from real news stories. So that's a horrendous threat to democracy, and that's why I feel so passionately about it. And I put it right up there on the top because I don't think America goes anywhere unless we go with a reformed media environment.
It's a great point, and one, of course, Thomas Jefferson and the other founders shared that if we don't have a vital, sometimes disruptive and at least critical, free press, we can't keep democracy going. You make the connection in a little more detail between consolidation and the loss of staff in newsrooms.
Well, I think what happens is when you have all of this consolidation that we have witnessed in the last 15 or 20 years, all of those deals cost a huge pile of money. Those deals have to be financed. And while the companies would have you believe there's going to be all kinds of efficiencies and economies that will benefit consumers, what really happens is their economies, usually the first place they look to achieve those economies is the newsroom. Cutting that newsroom, or if there's two stations that are joining, maybe just have one station left, fire half of the reporters, cut down on the investment in the news. Wall Street is not impressed by the quality of the news that is covered by our newspapers or our radio and television stations. They're impressed by the quarterly returns, the bottom line every 3 months. How's the station doing? And a station can be doing good, or a newspaper can be doing pretty good, and if they're earning 15% this year, you know, then Wall Street's going to say, well, you got to earn 17 next year. And if you make 17 next year, then they're going to want 20. And it's just the unforgiving expectations of the marketplace. And, you know, this kind of consolidation has come to a lot of industries. Telecommunications and media are not the Lone Rangers here at all. But this is a very special industry. This is an industry that's at the heart of our democracy. This is an industry that uses a public resource to make its money. That's the spectrum that you and I and your listeners own. It's not a company that really owns a Hertz of spectrum in the United States. They're given licenses and privileges to use the spectrum, and in the case of broadcasting, to use that spectrum to benefit the public interest and to keep people informed and bring them news and information and diversity of entertainment that's good for them. But yeah, it's hard to find the exact figures, but I've seen anywhere from 20 to 30,000 reporters, people, newsroom employees who don't have jobs anymore, who had them, 10 or 15 years ago, And that's a hemorrhage that democracy cannot stand. But the beat goes on. The beat goes on. You know, they would have you believe that, oh, we're through with consolidation, but every day you open the paper now, we have Comcast trying to take over Time Warner Cable. We've got Sinclair buying up a whole bunch of stations. We've got Tribune buying up stations. So it's just getting to be a universe that's run by four and by and for big capital, big media titans, and unfortunately the public interest is not being very well served by that.
You've written in the Columbia Journalism Review quite recently, and I think it's worth quoting, Sinclair, Tribune, and the News Corporation during the last 15-year period went on buying sprees, and the major networks extended their influence by buying some stations and affiliating with others. Gone are hundreds of once independent broadcast outlets. And then you put in the kicker. Instead of these hundreds of independent outlets today, we have a short list of nationwide, and here's the point, homogenized and de-journalized empires that respond more to quarterly reports than to the information needs of citizens.
Yep.
Hard to put it any more brilliantly than that. Homogenized and de-journalized enterprises running around under the false slogan or false appearance of presenting news.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, I'm not out to indict all broadcasters. I think there are a lot of broadcasters, and you're certainly one of them who serves the public interest and lives to serve the public interest. I think there's a lot who were with independent stations or grew up within families who had independent local stations. And I think the flame of the public interest still burns in the breast of a lot of those people. But they don't control the market anymore. They're not captains of their own fate. They're captives to the unforgiving expectations of Wall Street and Madison Avenue. So, you know, their choices are to either play the game by the big guy's rules or else they're voted off the island. That's it. They're bought out or they go out of business.
And for the 30,000 reporters, that's exactly what's happened. They've been.
That's right. They're off the island. And that's a cost that we cannot pay. You're exactly right when you said before, getting the news out to all the people has a long tradition in this country. And it goes back, really, to the founding fathers. You know, people would have you think, oh, back then, in those days, government didn't do anything, and it was all private free enterprise that built the United States of America. But when George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison launched this experiment in democracy of ours, they knew that they were playing risky business. This was something that really hadn't been tried on that kind of scale before, and they were not 100% sure it was going to work. So you can look at their letters, and then you can look at the laws they passed after that. Their conclusion was, we need, if it's going to work, the one thing we need is an informed electorate. So let's try to make sure we have an informed electorate. Now, there weren't a lot of wonderful, objective newspapers at that period of time. There were a lot of partisan journals that were probably even more bitter than some of the stuff that you hear and see right now. But that was what we had. And their decision was, so let's get this stuff out to the people. Let's get information, whatever we've got, and let them make up their own minds, but just so they know what's going on. So what did they do? They built postal roads all around the country, and they gave newspapers postal subsidies so that those papers could go out at really minimal cost, and people everywhere around the country could read them. And that was one of the largest, maybe the largest expense of the federal government after national defense back then. We're talking in 1700s now, 1790s, early 1800s. And that kind of approach, you know, when we could fast forward to when we got into radio and television and broadcast license, the same kind of deal. We'll let you use this public resource, give you a license for it, which is kind of a subsidy in a way. But you got to serve the public interest and help inform the people in return for that. Now we got this new era of the internet, and we got to figure out how we're going to make that serve the public interest. And as you noted before, we can talk more about that in a while. It's not going down the the ideal road either. But
let's come back.
It's an American tradition, really, and it's at the heart and soul of our democracy to have an informed electorate. When you don't have an informed electorate, then you dumb down the civic dialogue and you make dumb decisions, and you mentioned a couple of them in your eloquent little essay at the top of the program.
Let's come back to that. I want to come back to the Internet. I want to come back to newspapers, and I want to come back to licensing, and I want to come back to Times Warner and Comcast. All of those lie ahead of us. We have to take a short break. We're talking to Michael Copps, a former FCC commissioner and a champion all around this country for opening up, keeping open the Internet and for recreating a diverse national media. Michael Copps and I will be right back after this short break. We're talking to Michael Copps, former FCC commissioner, and I have to say one of my heroes for the work, Michael, that you're doing and continue to do in spite of overwhelming financial odds against us. But it's
terrific. You're very generous, sir. Thank you.
You're terrific. And
you're one of mine, too. I think if we had more broadcasters like you around the country, we'd be in a hell of a lot better shape.
Well, we're lucky to have a little college-run independent station here, which allows us to do just the thing that you're encouraging the country to do as a whole, which is to have our own opinions and throw those opinions into. So independent public radio is really quite a marvelous thing. But let's turn one more thought to, on the consolidation question. This is not only a fact that that affects television or radio. It also affects newspapers and magazines and films. They're all part of the same giant combines. Say something about the newspapers and the significance of their role in maintaining a diverse and a live public opinion.
Well, they've been through really tough times, as you know, and the model that once supported newspapers, the advertising model, has pretty well been eviscerated. It may be that we don't have that kind of model available to us anymore where you can support that kind of journalism that we had in the 1950s and in the 1960s. And part of that, of course, is due to the coming of the Internet and Craigslist and the advertising there. But I think it started before that. I think it started with all of this consolidation there, too, and the disappearance of local newspapers, the gobbling up of papers by a few great big newspaper complexes. So they're a shell of their former selves, too. They're playing the same consolidation game. And a lot of them are owned, believe it or not now, by private equity firms. Not local owners, local journalists, but hedge funds and private equity firms actually owning these newspapers. And you can imagine how dedicated some of them are to really fact-based, truth-telling journalism.
That needs to be repeated.
But it's a fact, though, that still, even today, probably 85% or more of the news that we see, even on the Internet, comes from the newspaper newsroom and the television newsroom. It's just that there's so much less of it because of the consolidation and because of the downsizing that you and I have been talking about. Now, we got to find a way then, and I think to keep newspapers going, and I think some of them are coming back. I've never been part of this group that says newspapers are going to disappear. I don't think they will, but we've got to start looking at some new ways to support them and incentivize them if that old advertising model is going to be very difficult to maintain and if it's largely gone. Then we have to look more at things like nonprofit models or maybe even some kind of public subsidies or whatever. But we're not doing a very good job of that. The IRS has to accord nonprofit status to anyone looking for it, and they've been kind of slow and tardy, asleep at the switch in making those approvals. But we need to be looking at options because we got to keep those newspapers going, and we have to find a model for news on the Internet. And we don't have that model right now. We have the Internet does a lot of wonderful things, but one of the things it doesn't do is provide a model for the kind of fact-based, resource-intensive journalism that the country needs. And the typical Internet news person, I think these days, you know, you get up in the morning, you go to work, and you you write a story, and then they give you a camera to go out and do another story, and then you do another story, and then you come back and write the blog, and if they own the news station, you go on the TV station and report, and then you do a few more stories, and it's very rare where you will find nowadays the editor who says, hey, Craig, take a year. Take 6 months or a year. Really dig into this. We've got a problem here, I think. Nail it down and hold the powerful accountable. That hold the powerful accountable journalism has largely disappeared. We've got a couple of dozen states don't even have a reporter anymore in Capitol Hill. We have state capitals that are virtually uncovered by professional press. You cannot hold the powerful accountable. You cannot find the truth without getting back to a resource-intensive journalism that will afford journalists the opportunity to go and do these things.
We have state capitals where there is no press reporter on site.
Very few. I mean, that used to be a big beat, and now you'll find that those things have hemorrhaged, and some of the foundations and all now are coming in and trying to send students down to cover the state capitol and all, and that's fine, but in another way, that's not a substitute for the reporter who's there all the time, and he's on the beat, and he knows who these reporters are and where the politicians are,
absolutely,
and where the skeletons are in the closet and all that sort of stuff. But so many bad things have come out of state capitals in recent years, and there's an organization that has pushed a lot of that, and it's called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC for short. ALEC has been around for about 40 years. I never heard of it until about two, three years ago when the Center for Media and Democracy and the Common Cause that I'm affiliated with now and Bill Moyers got on the case and unearthed what they were doing. But it turns out that many of the big corporations of America were contributing to the formation of this group, ALEC. And ALEC's modus operandi is to hold weekend sessions around the country at nice resorts and places like that, and they invite legislators and I guess legislators and their wives and their husbands to come down and spend a weekend and listen to their conservative take on policy. And then when they go and get ready to go back home, they say, here's a model bill. Why don't you consider taking this back to your state legislature and put it in? And it might be something that leads to voter suppression or election unreform, or taking the regulatory apparatus out of those states and putting them out of business. For instance, let me give you one good example. You know, we're trying to build broadband in this country and bring broadband and the Internet to every citizen. We're not doing a very great job of it. We're behind. We're number 16 or 20th, depending upon what rating you read. It used to be number one or number two, but we haven't done a very good job of that. That's because a lot of the big companies, Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast, when they look in the area, they pick out the affluent area where they can cherry pick, go in and make a lot of money, and everybody else lives on the other side of the track or even across the street sometimes if the neighborhood kind of changes its characterization. And then they go on somewhere else. So in many cases, municipalities have said, well, why don't we build our own broadband? Figure it out with a private-public partnership with another company. If AT&T, Verizon, or Comcast doesn't want to do it, we can do that ourselves. And we've had some really noticeable successes where that's worked, like in Chattanooga and Lafayette, Louisiana, and about 100 other places around the country. But all of a sudden, ALEC said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. And ALEC's members include AT&T and Verizon and Comcast. So they have managed to get bills passed in 19 or 20 states now, prohibiting or making very, very, very difficult the ability of municipalities to build their own broadband, even in areas where they don't want to build right now, the big companies. But, you know, maybe they'll be back in a few years. In the meanwhile, they don't want anybody else mucking around in there. So you've got 19 or 20 states now where you can't really do that, and that's another thing that's holding us back. But those big companies, the big telecom companies, are still members of ALEC and doing that now. After Moyers and Common Cause and the Center for Media and Democracy shine the spotlight on Alec. A lot of the big companies, General Motors and Walmart and some of the big banks and all that, they got a little bit nervous and they let their membership expire, in some cases even withdrew their membership. But I haven't seen telecom companies do that yet. So all of this has been going on in the States, and I consider myself a reasonably well-informed person. I've been working in this city for 40-some years, 44 years now. I never heard of Alec. That's a function, I guess, of the fact that we don't have the kind of journalism that we really need to be having in the state capitals to unearth what's going on and tell the American people what's going on. Only way we can reverse this municipal broadband thing now would be for Congress to pass a law preempting all those state laws. That's not going to happen. Or the Federal Communications Commission exercising some authority, which I think they do have the capacity to do this, to preempt those states from prohibiting the construction of municipal broadband.
You mentioned it, a moment ago the possibility of, and I want to go back to it because it's intriguing and I haven't heard it mentioned before, the possibility of using a nonprofit model for newspapers and perhaps even internet news. And we have the PBS, the public broadcasting system, which is theoretically, probably is a nonprofit model. Are you suggesting the possibility that there could be nonprofit publicly owned newspapers or internet providers?
Well, I think there can be nonprofit, not necessarily public owned. I think there can be nonprofit privately owned, but that's one discussion we need to have. The other one is what you just mentioned, is support for public media, and we do not support public media here in the country because everybody lives in fear listening to the shouting heads of the cable and radio. Oh, that's going to mean government control of content, government control of the news. And as a result, every listener listening to us right now is paying every year about $1.42, I think was the last figure I saw, to support public media in the United States every year. This is like, the public radio, the public broadcast, and all of this stuff. $1.42. It doesn't even buy you a cup of coffee anymore in most places. Other countries, Great Britain, $50, $80. Scandinavian countries, $200, $300, $400. And I'm not suggesting that we mimic the exact kind of media system we have there, but it just shows the huge discrepancy in the way they support their media. Now, if you look, if you're going to say, yeah, but that's going to endanger, that's going to be government control of the news. If you look at a lot of these countries, they're very democratic countries, small d democratic countries. Every year there's a ranking that comes out that's a widely respected ranking of which are the most democratic countries in the world. The United States is no longer anywhere near the top of that list. A lot of the countries that are ahead of us are countries that do have publicly supported media, that are investing in it, and that were smart enough to figure out how to build firewalls, which isn't rocket science, to build firewalls to make sure that there's no government control over the news, that there are walls and separations between the helpful finance that government could bring and the news itself. So it can be done. And again, if that old model is gone that we talked about a few minutes ago, we got to have new models, and we have to have a discussion about public media and nonprofit media and anything else creative that the mind of man or woman can come up with. But if all we're going to have in the way of a debate is some silly argument about, oh, government control or regulation versus deregulation, and not dig into the facts and not try to find out what's going on, then our media is just going to continue to diminish.
We're talking to Michael J. Copps, a hero of mine, a former commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission. And just to recap a little, we've been talking about the consolidation of media, American media, in television, radio, magazines, newspapers, the reduction of news outlets from 50 plus or 100 plus outlets now down, or hundreds perhaps of outlets now down to six major news sources or six major media controllers, people at the gate. We've added to that the control of the internet by a few major controllers, and we've been talking about how the sacrifice is the sacrifice of diversity, the sacrifice of independent investigative reporting, the sacrifice of points of view that are not not appreciated or not condoned by the six major combines, and the gradual suffocation of the democratic process by the elimination of factual reports or factual reporting, and the gradually decreasing staffs of newspapers and television stations for doing the kind of long-term six-month studies or six-month investigative reports that might have been like the Watergate evaluation at the Washington Post years ago, things that took years or months and months and months to uncover, or the things that have gone on now to uncover the work of ALEC. Those long-term investigative jobs are not being done by newspapers or television stations or really just about anybody else today. And so what Mike Copps has been describing here is the starvation, suffocation or starvation of one major source of influence and information in a democratic society, which has put the American public, the American listening and attentive public, behind the eight ball, unable to find sources of information that are trustworthy. And then Mike, you've just bridged over to the internet itself. And many folks have said in the last 20 years, well, the internet could create a kind of conversation to which everybody is invited, and which requires us allows us to share multiple opinions by anybody. Nobody needs to get a registration to participate in the conversations on the internet, and therefore the hope is the internet. What's wrong with that picture, Mike Copps?
Well, indeed it could, and indeed it's not. But I think that was the original expectation of a lot of people, and I think a lot of folks kind of assured themselves that, well, they don't need to worry about this stuff that Craig Barnes and Mike Copps are talking about, the evils that descended upon newspapers and radio and television and cable, because now we got this new gizmo, gee whiz, internet, and it is so powerful, it is so dynamic, it is so opportunity creating that there's no chance that it's going to go down the same road that that those older communications systems went down. But lo and behold, now we're into 2014, and I think it's becoming clear to a lot more people every day that the internet is bedeviled by this, that it is showing signs of going down the same road, that not only the access to it, controlled by a few, the big internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon and AT&T, but the big companies on the internet itself who are huge and squeezing out, I think, a lot of entrepreneurship and innovation and all the rest. So we're at a critical juncture here. If we let the gatekeepers take control of the access to the internet and the internet itself and tell us what we're going to see and direct us to where they want us to go, then we lose that enabling journalism that we talked about, that we need to nourish the democratic dialogue. And that would be, given the power of the technology, what broadband can do and what internet can do, we ought to be in a golden age of communications. But more and more we're having to play defense here, and the consolidation continues, and the internet looks less and less open, and all these companies begin to look more and more alike. You know, just if I can take a minute and go back, we'll talk about the Comcast Time Warner Cable pending deal here.
Yes.
I imagine in a couple of minutes, but go back a few years ago, 2009, and Comcast came marching into the office at the FCC and said, "We want to buy NBC Universal." Which was then owned by General Electric, but Comcast said, "We want to do this." I was the only commissioner who voted against approving that deal, and here's why. I looked at it and I said, "My goodness, look at the power you're giving one company. This is about broadcast, cable, and the internet. It's about cable internet, It's about old media. It's about new media. It's content and distribution. Comcast became, was the cable company.